your source for everything paranormal.
Para-X.
The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Within the law you must, in perfect love and perfect trust. Mind the threefold laws you should, three times bad and three times good. These eight words the reed fulfill, and ye harm none, do what ye will.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hi, Merry Meet, everybody. My guest tonight is Dr. Matthew McKay, and we'll be talking about his book, The Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife, which is Jordan's message to the living on what to expect in the afterlife. Now, Dr. McKay is a clinical psychologist, professor of psychology at the Wright Institute, co-founder of Haight-Ashbury Psychological Services, founder of Berkeley CBT Clinic, and co-founder of the Bay Area Trauma Recovery Clinic, which services low-income clients. He's authored and co-authored more than 40 books, including the Relaxation and Stress Reduction Workbook, Seeking Jordan, and the publisher of New Harbinger Publications. As usual, questions and comments from those listening in to the live broadcast in the chat room are welcome. And those listening live and you're not in the chat room can come over to paraxradionetwork.com. And for those of you who are listening on podcasts, I want you to know that you can join us live every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific time. We've got so much to cover today, as usual, but especially today somehow. So, Dr. McKay, come in. Welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be with you. Thank you.
Let's tell everybody a little bit. The book is a channeled guide to the life-death transition experience and how to prepare ourselves. And it's kind of an introduction to the afterlife. But before we get into the book itself, I think we should probably start out with a backstory. So for those who may not be familiar with your book, Seeking Jordan, let's start there. Because before Jordan's passing, you didn't have any belief that the dead could speak to us. And then he began speaking to you.
Yes, I really was agnostic. I had no strong beliefs about anything, and in fact, when Jordan was living, he had very much the same view of things. But when he died, I think I wanted to know the things that anyone craves to know who has lost someone they love deeply. And I wanted to know, does he still exist? I wanted to know, is he in a good place? Is he okay? Is he happy? And so I set out to find him and to find some way of communicating with him so I could learn whether those things were true, whether he still existed and whether he was in a place that felt good to him. So that was a journey that started just really very short time after he died. He was murdered on his way home from work and on his way home to this, where he lived with his girlfriend, and he was just, you know, plucked out of this earth, this world. And so I wanted to know where he was, and I went through various processes trying to reach him. I used mediums at first. I went to see Alan Botkin, who was a psychologist like me, who had discovered accidentally a way of communicating with the dead. It's called induced after-death communication. I went to see him and had that experience, and actually in that experience could hear Jordan as a voice outside of myself. telling me some of the things that I needed to know and needed to, you know, that he was still with us, that he still watched over us, that he loved us, that he's in a good place. So I learned some of those things that were really important to me. But what I still couldn't do was have a conversation. I was getting one side of communication, whether it was from a medium or through Dr. Botkin's process of induced after-death communication. In all cases, it was just, you know, getting listening passively for something that Jordan might say, but I wasn't able to really convey to him my questions, my concerns, my interest, my hope. And so eventually I began working with the late Ralph Metzner, a psychologist who also specialized in the after-death experience and in after-death awareness and communication. And he taught me how to channel, how to actually communicate to those on the other side using language. And that was the beginning of a process of learning from Jordan what really is happening in the afterlife.
So, I mean, how long did it take for your academic mind to realize that it actually was possible to communicate to the other side?
Well, I think the first experience, you know, when you go to mediums, it's like it's an act of belief. You're sitting there, and the medium is telling you, oh, you know, your loved one is sitting right here, and he's telling you this, this, and this. But the but Alan Botkin's experience was profound. Maybe I should say a little bit more about that. Induced after-death communication is based on a treatment for trauma called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And I use it myself with my clients. We use it a lot in our trauma clinic. And it helps resolve trauma pain. And Botkin used it a lot with vets and at the VA and accidentally made a small modification in the procedure, in the protocol, and the particular vet he was working with had a full awareness, communication that he could hear, he could see, he could feel this beloved child that he had lost in Vietnam. And Botkin didn't know what to make of it, and later on did a study with 83 other vets who had profound traumatic grief, and using the small modification in the EMDR protocol, in 81 of those cases, they had a full experience of their loved one. And I used his protocol myself with some of my clients who have had profound losses. And of course, I'm not as good as Botkin, and I'm batting about 50%. But when it happens, it's an extraordinary experience where you actually fully experience the presence of that loved one. They're talking, you can see them. And in some cases, you can feel and hug them. So it's a profound experience. And that was the beginning for me of realizing, oh, my God, it is possible to communicate with those on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say that you wrote the author's introduction, and the body of the book is written by Jordan, who channeled through you. And he begins by writing about his death and his transition, and then proceeds to cover all bases about what it's like transitioning from here to there, what to expect, the process. And now Jordan is a soul who has been here, and like most of us, back and forth many times over, many lifetimes. And you have done a past life regression. So have you shared any other lifetimes with his soul?
Yes, I have. And, you know, Ralph actually did a number of past life regressions with me, and I discovered a number of past lives. In one case, in the Middle Ages, we lived in a yeshiva. We were Jewish, and we were rabbis. And he was an older rabbi, and I was a young whippersnapper, and he befriended me, took me under his wing, and after his death in that life, he was communicating with me. In another life, Jordan was my wife. We had children together. And he died early in that life, and I had to deal with his loss there. And so there are a number of lives that that I'm aware of, where our souls have intersected and incarnated in the same place and time, and had various kinds of relationships. And that's what's true about reincarnation, is that we're part of soul groups, and we incarnate often together, and it's sort of like a little repertory company that comes into the world in a certain time and place and location, and in each of these incarnations, our relationships vary. In some cases, as with Jordan and I, we're husband and wife, father, son, mentor, mentee. I mean, so the relationships can be quite different from one life to another, but what is consistent from one life to another is that there's deep love between souls that incarnate from the same soul group.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking that perhaps it would be easier for a soul that has experienced death many times would lose the fear of death each time they pass. But in the book, you know, he writes that post-death navigation is sometimes rather disconcerting. We kind of experience amnesia, we flounder around for a while, we're totally unprepared. And that was the reason that he wanted to write this book, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there were two things that were very important to him. One is that so many of us, you know, the estimates are like up to 80% of people actually have some very significant fear of death that haunts them. So that was one reason that he wants to help people with that fear. And the second thing he wanted to do was to show them a little bit more about what is on the other side and how we can prepare ourselves for the transition from living with a nervous system, you know, inside of a body, inside of a physical universe, into a world in which all of that is gone. We see in 360 rather than just straight ahead. We hear not through our ears, but through telepathy. When we want to move, we don't use our legs. We move by just intention, by the desire to go from one place to another. So this, everything is changing. And perhaps the biggest thing that changes is that what we think about and what we image in our minds, we actually then can very often see. So we actually hallucinate what we have in our mind. So if we show up post-death at the landing place, which is this spot just adjacent to the spirit world where we first enter, if we show up there with a lot of fear and with a lot of, you know, concern and struggle, we often hallucinate things that frighten us further and prevent us from really seeing what's there, hearing what's there, appreciating the love that's surrounding us. We're kind of deaf to all of that, because we're preoccupied with our fear and with images of danger.
Yeah, and you wrote in the author's introduction that the fear of death actually changes our actual experience of death, and that kind of makes me think that fear is like shooting ourselves in the foot when we're still here. It's got to be kind of a difficult thing, you know, to prepare something that you really don't know about, but it was kind of nice to know, in a sense, that, you know, all this is normal. Like when he was describing his transition, you know, one minute he was down still on the earth plane looking at his body and realizing that perhaps he was dead, but it wasn't like he followed the light, in a sense, I don't think, unless I misread this, but somehow his soul was pulled up kind of on its own. It knew where to go, like, you know, he knew where home was, kind of thing. Is that right?
Yeah, for a while he was pretty confused, and he wasn't fully aware that he was dead. It began to dawn on him that something was terribly wrong when he would try to move and his limbs wouldn't move. He couldn't make his body move. He knew something had happened. He could visualize and see, you know, his home. He could see his girlfriend. It was late at night, sleeping in bed. He could actually telepathically travel and see those things. and he was confused as to, you know, what was happening here. And at some point, he began to kind of notice that there was a tug. There was something kind of pulling him away from the scene and upward. And he had to sort of let go to that and allow that to happen. And I guess I want to just make some point here about that there are lots of souls who die and are actually still are unaware that they're dead, or they're so consumed by and engaged with the drama of their death or the recent issues in their life and the emotions that surround all of that, that they aren't ready to kind of let go, and they ignore that tug, they ignore that pull to kind of let go and move away from the physical plane. And these are people we call ghosts. You know, for a while they linger, and in some degree of confusion, but also in some cases consumed by emotions that really kind of prevent them from entering the spirit world. One of the things that Jordan says a lot, or talks about a lot, is that when we get to the landing place, you know, we have to go through this period of adjustment, recognizing that we're no longer embodied, and learning how to recognize that there are guides and souls there to greet us and support us. But also what has to happen there is that whatever residual emotions and struggles and affect and pain that we may have, and fear that we may have brought with us from that immediately past life, we have to kind of get through that and resolve that before we can get in the spirit world, because you cannot be in the spirit world with intense anger, intense fear. I mean, those emotions don't belong there. They don't fit. And so we have to, in some cases, go through a period of healing right in that antechamber that adjacent to the spirit world. There are places for healing and resolving some of that pain. And we may have to spend some time working through that with the help of guides before we're ready to kind of matriculate into the world of spirit. So the problem of having a lot of residual intense emotions and drama from the past life, that has to be kind of worked through before we're ready to get through the portals.
And so the soul actually has free will. It can think it's not ready to go down. And I was talking to several people that said that some of the souls are afraid to go up religiously because maybe they did something in this world and they're afraid to let go because they think they're going to hell. You know, I think there's a lot of different reasons why spirit just stays put sometimes. But
that's really important what you just said, because I think a lot of us have these ideas about what awaits us in the spirit world. You know, it may be a place of judgment where we could be cast into damnation. That there are people there evaluating our life and determining whether we're worthy of some kind of heavenly existence or not. And none of that is true. There is no evaluation. There is no damnation. There is no hell. And Jordan has been very, very clear about that. The spirit world has no judgment whatsoever. It's all acceptance. It's allowing. But it's learning. We go there, and part of our work is to review our lives and learn from our mistakes and see what we did and didn't do and how it affected others. So there's a process of learning, but it's not about, you know, are we worthy, are we good, are we bad, making some kind of dichotomous judgment about our life and how we lived it.
Yeah, and there was a question that came in from the chat room, and she was asking, do you think people are afraid of the afterlife because they may not have a choice as to where their souls go? So we've kind of pretty much covered that in a sense.
You know, and people are afraid, and they think that they're, you know, that someone is going to evaluate them and send them to the dark place or the place of eternal fire, and all that And so they have these images in their mind. And sometimes when they show up at the landing place, they're seeing those things. They're hallucinating devils and fire and terrifying images of judgment and rejection, because that's what their religious background led them to expect. And it takes a while for them to kind of recognize that, that isn't happening. It also takes a while, by the way, to remember who we are. So the amnesia that we have when we come to this earth, we don't remember our past lives, we don't remember our life in the spirit world, we don't remember our soul group. All of these things are forgotten for good reason, because it helps us learn and take seriously the struggles of this life. But it takes a while for us to get through that amnesia. So when we get to the landing place, often we still can't really remember who we are and where we come from. And it takes a little while from all that amnesia to fade, and for the memories of our past lives and all of our experiences in the spirit world to come back to us. So it's a process. And while we're in that process, while we still haven't fully recovered our memories and who we are, we're kind of in the state of, one word is confusion, but a state of evolving. We're moving from one state to another, from the physical world and all of how it works, to the spirit world and a completely different set of rules and laws and experiences. So it is a process, and all of that is, that's for some people who expect judgment and pain and fire. It's a process that is kind of disturbed by those beliefs and images.
And we just got a question that kind of goes along with that. She wants to know what you think of the Buddhist death practices of 8 days of prayer and instruction over the body, spirit. Are they aiding the soul?
That's a wonderful question. I mean, I think we have to differentiate between the value of practices for the living and the value of practices for the dead. The living get a lot from those practices, those 8 days of prayer, from this letting go process of letting go of that soul, of that loved one, and so all of those rituals have profound and important benefits for the living. The ones who have died, actually, they're not really necessary. Because they're on their journey, and there are guides and loved ones on the other side who are helping them all the way, and they don't necessarily. I mean, certainly they can feel the love, they can feel the support and care coming from loved ones who are still embodied, but they don't need it in order to make the transition. They're getting lots of help in the spirit world.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, let's talk about the landing place a little bit more in depth, because we, as you said, get kind of lost when we get to the other side. But the thing that struck me, and there's several other places that we talk about in the book that we know as perhaps something else, more like religious, like the landing place to me would be the equivalent of the pearly gates for some religious people, and, you know, with St. Peter and his book up there. But it isn't really a place, is it? I mean, it's more like a stopover to get your bearings with help, as you said, with the other souls, and kind of like either a grounding or maybe a basic being a soul 101 kind of thing, right?
You're exactly. That's my understanding from Jordan. With just what you said, it's a transitional place. It's something. It's a place to get our bearings, and it may take a little while to get our bearings. And what Jordan described, the landing place for him is this place with these sort of unreal colors of this beautiful garden, but sort of hyper real colors and shapes and so forth, and that was supposed to be calming and give him a sense, in its beauty of safety. And generally speaking, the landing place is created for us. It's not physical. It's created through energy, and the images that we see there are energy rather than physical matter. But it's created especially for us. You know, people that come from different planets, who have incarnated different planets, have landing places that look very different because the landing place looks like beautiful and peaceful places from your particular planet. And so the landing place is designed specially for each of us. And it is that place where we go through that transition of figuring out, you know, what's different now. And also, you know, one of the things that Jordan talks about is that, you know, how we communicate in the spirit world is through the medium of love. And so, you know, in the same way when we talk here, we make air molecules vibrate, and air is the, sort of the medium through which we communicate sound. In the spirit world, the medium of communication, of telepathic communication, is love, is that actual experience of love. And if you arrive in the landing place full of distress and anger or sadness or other kinds of upsetting emotions or residuals from your just lived life, you are kind of deaf to love. And so there's a way in which it takes a little while to start noticing and hearing the love that's all around you. Because initially, you may really not be able to see, feel, or hear the communications of love that are there to support you. So it is. It's a place where we have to go through a period of adjustment.
And I'm thinking as you're talking about, you know, the love, I think there's also, maybe this is a human trait, but maybe there's also some trust that we need to get over with too. Trusting ourselves in what we're seeing, trusting in, you know, who we're communicating with, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're right. And that's one of the reasons why loved ones who have died are often part of that group who greet us in the landing place. There's guides there, but there are also souls that we know and recognize and love who are there to kind of give us a safe sense of safety and trust. Oh, these are the people that I've been waiting to see, that I've longed to see, that I thought I'd lost, and here they are. Right, these souls are right in front of me, and there's this great leaping of joy when finally the soul arriving in the landing place recognizes some of the loved ones that are there to greet. And again, though, that may not be immediately apparent because that soul who just is landing may be preoccupied with other things. I mean, even Jordan described when he got in the landing place, he was so, befuddled by what was going on, and he noticed that whatever he thought about, he could see it in front of him. And he thought about the house that he lived in with us, that he grew up in, and he could see it. It was right there in front of him. Boom. And then he tried to think of something calming, and he loves the Yosemite, so he thought about Yosemite, and he could see everything. And Yosemite was suddenly, the landing place was Yosemite. It was the waterfalls and the great cliffs. And then he thought about, for some reason, elephants, and now he had an elephant tromping around Yosemite. So whatever he thought about, he would see, and it was very hard to distinguish between these images that he was projecting and the physical reality that, you know, of the life that he's immediately left.
Mm-hmm. Boy, someone with a very vivid imagination could really go to town and have a good time being able to do that. But I think one thing, you know, that's important, and I think some people, well, a lot of people worry about this, is because they're so unsure about getting to the other side, or if there is another side, because there are people that have had near-death experiences that come back and say, well, I didn't remember anything. I didn't see white light and whatever, you know, kind of putting the kibosh on there. But I think a lot of people are really concerned about being able to see their loved ones after death. So it's good to know that you know, they can be greeters, or they could, you know, just pop up any other time. But I think, you know, it would be a good idea if you saw somebody, a familiar face rather than a guide, and you're still kind of walking around. It would be nice to see family. And it's not just you wouldn't see them. You can see them anytime you want, right?
That's true, because once we get out of the landing place and into the spirit world proper, within a relatively short time, we go to our soul group and rejoin all these loved ones. And of course, the soul group is just like a little family, but there are also adjacent soul groups and sort of families of souls that are psychologically nearby to us, and with whom often we do share lives as well. And so we go back to our family, but also our neighborhood of many souls that we know, we love, we've had, you know, many lifetimes with. We've had extraordinary experiences with these souls. And so we're surrounded by the love of these souls that we know so well. And that's one of the most beautiful parts about, truthfully, about death and returning to the spirit world is being able to reclaim all those relationships that sometimes that we think are lost. You know, your father mm-hmm. died, your mother died, people you, in my case, Jordan, people you love deeply. And yet when you get to the spirit world, they're right there. And the joy of reclaiming those relationships and embracing those souls is just extraordinary.
It's got to be. And then if you get into all the ancestors and all the different past lives, you got a lot of people over there to say hello to once you get there.
That's right.
But we've got to say hello to a break right now. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back, everybody, with Dr. McKay in the blink of an eye.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back, so don't go away.
If you end up with webbed feet,
remember, you've been warned.
Explore the second edition of the Witch's Oracle deck through 45 innovative cards and enhanced guidebook that peers into the world of the witch. The deck's stunning artwork has a new look and includes 7 brand new inspirational cards. Each card now includes a suggested crystal or gemstone to enhance your reading, as well as a magical incantation that provides energy, reinforces the card's meaning, and helps the desired message to be sent out into the universe. The easy-to-navigate guide also has a new look and offers straightforward, gentle guidance that takes readers through both good times and bad. And now includes a chapter on crystal and gemstone divination by the amazing Nicholas Pearson. The Witch's Oracle. It is a perfect divination deck for witches as well as non-pagans, and is designed to suit both seasoned readers and beginners alike. Find out more about the Witch's Oracle deck at www.marlabrooks.com, and you can purchase the deck from shifferbooks.com, amazon.com, or order a copy from your favorite bookseller.
UAN Now. News and discussion of the metaphysical, the occult, the paranormal, and much, much more. With your hosts, UAN High Priestess Reverend Lily Alley, head of the Draken chapter of the Order of Paranormal Exploration, Christine Matza. The New Aeon is now. Join us every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern for New Aeon Now.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, for those of you who might have come in late, my guest tonight is Dr. Matthew McKay, and we're talking about his book, The Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife, Jordan's Message to the Living on What to Expect After Death. And we've got another question. We'll just jump right into it. Question is that you were describing a three-dimensional afterlife. Are there other dimensions as well, possibly for human spirits?
I've been told that, well, first of all, you know, we live in a three-dimensional physical world. The afterlife really isn't three-dimensional in terms of my understanding of it. For one thing, time is a very different experience in the afterlife than it is here. And I guess what I'm wanting to say is that there are locations in the afterlife, and also in certain forms of physical reality that have different dimensions than we have here. And so I guess the question about, you know, what is dimensionality in the afterlife? And I think the answer is it's nothing like what we know here in three dimensions. It's just, let's take time, for example. In the afterlife, they can watch the entire history of the Earth and everything that's happened on this planet. In fact, they can watch the entire history of the universe and see it from beginning to end from one position. And so it's so time, as we understand it, doesn't exist in the afterlife. Time in the afterlife is actually different in the sense that the time in the afterlife measures the point at which you didn't know something and then the point at which you learned or discovered something. And the difference between that is what time is in the afterlife. The difference between the point where you didn't know something to the point you learned something, that's time is about learning. It's about discovering in the afterlife. It's about gaining new knowledge. The time you didn't know something to the time you did know something, that's how time is measured in the afterlife. We're on Earth, time is a measurement of change.
I can't even get my head wrapped around that. All of a sudden, we know the whole history of the Earth and the universe. I mean, that's amazing.
One thing I would add is that souls can incarnate at different points in human history. So a soul, for example, could incarnate in 1920. And their next incarnation could be, you know, in the Stone Age, or their next incarnation could be some, you know, X centuries from now, so they don't have to incarnate in sequence with Earth time. Souls tend to do that; they tend to incarnate in sequence because it's less disruptive for them. So a soul incarnate in 1920 and now it comes back in 2020. It still has very familiar things. There's still cars, there's still trains, there's still all kinds of things that are familiar. And so souls tend to incarnate sequentially, but it isn't necessary. They could actually bounce around from one point of history to another.
Wow. Can they just, if they're going to reincarnate, does that mean they stay there, or can they go back in spirit as well? And just like if somebody wanted to see, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire or something, could they just, you know, go back for that little time in spirit and watch it?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the main ways souls do that is through the Akashic Record. They can open the Akashic Record as if we were opening a DVD, and they can look at any point in history and study it, or any moment in history and study it. A choice that an individual made and see exactly how that choice impacted everyone around them and maybe changed the momentum of history in some way. They can watch all of that. It's like opening, again, a video or you opening the pages of a book and seeing that. The other thing that they can do, which is really cool, is they can look in the Akashic Record and say, well, supposing this soul had done something else, supposing they'd made another choice, or they can even look back at their own life. Supposing I had made a different choice, or I had chosen X than Y, and they can actually see how that choice would have played out. They can see the entire movie of that new dimension, or that new reality of what would have occurred and all the ways people would have been affected by that one different choice. So it's a tremendous learning device. The Akashic Record gives us an opportunity to learn all kinds of things about how choices affect us and our life and all the lives around us.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to bring that up, actually, because, you know, I mentioned that when we were talking about the landing place, to me that was kind of what people would think is the pearly gates. Then we've got the Bardos, which is written about in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But here in this life, we would probably think that was purgatory, perhaps, you know, a place where souls go to struggle. And now when they go into the life review, I guess I didn't read that part of it or something, but the minute I heard about the life review, then I thought about the Akashic Records. And so there's so many similarities that we know, but they're just known by different names, I think, from here to across the air.
I think that's exactly right. I think that you know, you could think about the Bardos as a form of purgatory, but unlike purgatory, the Bardos are not where we're being punished or paying for our sins, or you know, going through a certain amount of suffering in order to somehow compensate for bad things we've done. The Bardos are just also places of learning. I mean, let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. Let's say a soul has been struggling with a sense of victimization, and they've been hounded and hurt in different ways, and they're still full of anger about it, and a desire for revenge, and so now they really can't get into the spirit world because they're full of all of these emotions that don't belong there. And so they might go to a Bardo in which scenarios would be created where this soul could work through those narratives, those expectations, you know, and guides actually create an environment where the soul can work through and work out some of those painful expectations and beliefs. And so very slowly, they can recover from the anger, from this overwhelming sense of victimization, and get ready to enter the spirit world. So Bardos are places of learning,
okay,
where souls go through special experiences created by guides to help them basically recover from some of the struggles and emotional distress that they felt on Earth.
Okay, another chat room question. They're lining up. he's asking, he said, if I was to die today, would I be able to, let's see, maybe the year 4000 in the Akashic Records, the future?
Yeah, once you're in the spirit world, you can have basically access to the Akashic record, I think pretty much at will. Oftentimes there's at the beginning, you know, when you first return to the spirit world, you may be supported or helped by guides to look through the Akashic record, but you have access to it. You know, you have to go through a few steps before that happens. For example, you mentioned the life review. The first thing that happens once we get in the spirit world, when we leave the landing place, and now we've gone through the so-called pearly gates, and we're in the spirit world, immediately there is this life review process where we, with the support and guidance of specialized guides, we look back over our entire life, the life that's just been lived. But in a special way, we don't just look at it like a sequence of events. We look at everything that we did, every choice we made, and we are aware of our own experience, but we're also simultaneously aware of how that choice affected everyone around us. And so we can feel the impact of whatever we did on all of those souls in our vicinity, and not only at the moment of that choice, but we can see and experience the effect of that choice over time. So, for example, if a father slaps his son, he during life he would experience it both as he experienced it and as his son experienced it, and not only at that moment, but has his son experienced that slap and the effect of that slap and that rejection over time, and so it's a profound experience. And the life review is great lessons, great learning, no judgment. It's not about you're right, you're wrong, you're good, you're bad. It's about just observing and learning and taking in the truth of how everything we do affects everyone around us.
Mm-hmm. That's true. All right, another question. This is when we were talking about what we see and what we can do. She said, so it's sort of like the human brain and daydreaming. You can pick and choose events, change them, say things. Is this mirroring the soul's ability in the afterlife?
I think, honestly, that never occurred to me, but I think that's right. that our ability to daydream and create images inside of our own mental process, our own the neural structures, of our brain, that ability probably is similar to or really the same as this ability to project images in the afterlife. Let me give you an example of this projecting images. You know, souls who live in a soul group often will agree upon what their environment is going to look like. In Jordan's soul group, it looks like a big farmhouse, and so they've agreed that they're going to create this image that they all can sort of live inside of, even though it's not a physical experience. The energy that they combined project to create that image creates an environment that they can live in, and all souls have this ability to project and create images that change their environment.
Okay. Another question. You're talking about time. She said, so if time isn't essential in the afterlife, does this answer the question as to why some spirits, such as Civil War soldiers, for example, can't accept that the year is now more than 150 years since they've passed on?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I'm not sure I have the total answer to it. One possibility is that somehow they've gotten stuck and have not actually matriculated into the spirit world and are still, kind of dwelling near or on the physical plane, even though they no longer have a body. So it may be difficult for them to accept that time has passed. It may be even difficult for them to accept that they died. And many souls are confused about that. They really don't know that they're dead. That's not the majority of souls. The majority of souls move right ahead and feel themselves the tug up to the spirit world. But some really do get stuck here for a period of time. So that may be, one possibility. But once a soul has reached the spirit world, their sense of time changes. They see time as a river. It's like, if you imagine this, you're looking at this long river, you're standing on the riverbank and you're watching time go by. But you can stand on that bank at any point on that river and watch any point of time. And so in the spirit world, we can watch the Civil War. We can watch Putin's war that's happening right now. We can experience any point of a past life. We can see backwards into early eras of Homo sapien, and we can even go beyond that to look at early periods of the evolution of the planet. So we can watch all of that from the spirit world. And usually we're not very confused because we understand that we're watching from outside of time, but watching the flow, a river of time, from outside of it, from the bank. Now, again, the Civil War soldier doesn't know the Civil War is over is probably a ghost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because sometimes, you go into shock and... that's what we hear. They're shocked and they just are afraid and they just stick to where they are. And probably they have the whole platoon with them. Or some of them at least.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have a friend that's a medium, and what she does, she says sometimes if a soul is lost here on Earth and it won't go back, she calls what she calls the soul police to come and... pick them up and get them and explain to them, and they usually bring somebody that person knows that's on the other side. It's so complicated, but it's really kind of wonderful altogether, isn't it?
Well, I think there's something really important about that, which is that we're not alone, even though we think we are sometimes. Or, in the moment immediately past following death, we may be confused. We don't know, what's happened. Or even when we get to the landing place, we're having a hard time really seeing or hearing or sensing what's there, the love and support that's there. But we aren't alone. Even if we don't know it, at a certain moment in time, we are surrounded by love. We're surrounded by guides and people who love us, who are helping us. The people who have died are still very aware of us. They're watching over us. They're often implanting thoughts and guidance in our minds and dreams that help support us to make certain changes or take certain directions. So we're this big family, and so we don't know it here. We forget that all of these lives are and these souls are intertwined with love. But nonetheless, they are, and all of those souls are there supporting us.
It's good to know. And I think a lot of people realize, too, that their loved ones are around at times. When we need them, or the spirit guides are around, guardian angels, whatever, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it, I really do think that we're never alone, unless you don't believe, and then you are alone because nothing's going to get through to you. That's how I see it. I mean, you have to keep an open mind and have a little faith.
Well, if you don't believe, you experience yourself as alone. The guides are still there. The loved ones are still there. Sometimes feeling pretty frustrated that they can't reach you or touch you. But your aloneness is an illusion, mm-hmm. and that's part of the struggle here. We come here, we forget everything, we forget our soul group, we forget all the loved ones on the other side. And we do feel and experience ourselves as alone. It's one of the great painful aspects of incarnating. And yet that aloneness is just an illusion. It is what we need to learn. One of the things that George talks a lot about is that we forget all of our past lives, our life in the afterlife. We forget all of that, because we come here to learn. We wouldn't take this life seriously if we know, I'm just here for a little while, and none of this really matters. I have a life in the spirit world, and I'll be back there soon. It's all of the things that deeply affect us, and that the lessons we're learning here mm-hmm. wouldn't be possible if we didn't take this place seriously.
Yeah, we're here for a reason.
We're here for a reason, yeah.
And life lessons are abounding, like it or not. Some of them aren't so much fun, but, that's the way it goes. Is there something like an average day in the afterlife?
Yeah. There's a lot that happens in the afterlife. I mean, most days have a certain amount of learning involved, where souls are, in many cases, souls in the afterlife are learning spiritual careers. They may be learning how to be a healer, learning how to be a guide, learning how to actually make and create things. There are these spiritual careers that that souls in the afterlife are developing special skills. And so that's one thing that's going on there. There's a lot of learning. There's a lot of, again, the use of the Akashic Record to review and learn about history and about one's own life and choices that could have been made differently. There's a lot of that kind of work that goes on. There's a lot of fun in the afterlife. What the afterlife is like going to college. It's like you go to class and you're learning stuff, but also, you're going to parties, you're having a heck of a good time with your friends, you're enjoying connections and discovery together. So it's structured where a lot of learning is going on in so-called average day in the afterlife, but there's also a lot of engagement and recreation. Souls do some merging in the afterlife, where it's two or three or four souls can actually merge their entities so that they're actually experiencing themselves inside of each other and mm-hmm. know each other in a very deep way. It's a very beautiful experience. That happens in the afterlife. There's a lot of creativity in the afterlife. Souls can create narratives and stories. They can create beautiful images. They create music. So there's a lot of pleasure. There's also tourism in the afterlife. Souls may journey in spirit to look at and observe other planets and other dimensions. And this tourism, as it is on Earth, is an opportunity to learn, about different places and cultures and ways of being, different kinds of creatures who incarnate into different kinds of bodies. There's an awful lot of learning that goes on from tourism. But souls in the afterlife also are keeping track of what's going on with the ones they love here. And so they may spend a certain amount of time actually observing and noticing and being with and in some way communicating to loved ones here. So all that stuff is going on. And the other thing that is kind of interesting about the afterlife is that souls can do two, three, or four, or five things at once. You know, here we can only focus on one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. But there, in the afterlife, a soul could be communicating to someone here on Earth that they love deeply. They could be involved in an educational and learning experience. And they might also be engaged in some kind of creative activity. All of that could be happening simultaneously. So souls can multiply their focus mm-hmm. in a way where they can do quite a bit at once.
And we thought multitasking down here was great. I think they got it first. We've got like 2 minutes, but you talk about in the book, and we can't get into this now, but anyone can learn to channel, right? And that you've got written in the book. And kind of the bottom line to all this is there any reason to fear death?
There's no reason whatsoever to fear death. I mean, of course, we have to go through a physical process where our body, our soul leaves our body. But I guess the important thing to know about that is that death is a minor event. It's merely a way of transitioning from one place to another. Just one thing I want to mention is that part of our soul always remains in the spirit world. So part of our soul is always in our soul group. It's always there in the spirit world. It's always engaged. It's always learning. And part of our soul enters the body. So we actually divide our soul energy when we incarnate. So we're always there, and then we all also enter a body and live a life here. So there's this beautiful thing that that we're all there right now. We mm-hmm. are all there, and those of us who are incarnating are also here, living a life and learning what we can learn in this place. So the key message from Jordan is there's no reason to fear death because we're all together anyway. We're mm-hmm. still together. The living and the dead are all together. We never lose them. They never lose us, and death is merely an opportunity to go home for a while and have all of our soul energy there in the afterlife and in the spirit world, and while preparing for the next life that we're going to choose.
Okay. Well, time has gone so fast. Do you have a website address that you can give out so people can do further research?
If anybody wants to learn a little bit more about Jordan, seekingjordan.com is a website that you can learn more about the things he's written and what he has to say.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's very informative. I'm going to get back my nose in the book and read a little bit more, but thank you for taking the time to be here.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Well, thank you. And let's thank all the people who are listening in, whether it's live or on the podcast. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at the same time for another great guest and more fun. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2009.
You have been listening to the Para-X Radio Network.